Now, Chekhov in Siberia, a program about Chekhov's journey to the island of Sakhalin, devised and performed by Michael Pennington.
My name is a popular name. Among Russian writers, I am number 37. There's not a single stain on my name. I've produced hundreds of short stories and one poem. Also, as you may know, I have sinned in the dramatic line, but not much because I don't like the theatre and I can't stand the act. What nonsense they talk. When they're young, they scrape their feet and neigh like donkeys. And when they're old, their voices become so hoarse with drinking you can't hear what they're saying. All the same, I have written a few plays. And Tolstoy says they're even worse than Shakespeare's. If I were asked, what is the essential characteristic of my life these days, I'd have to say insomnia. Every night I go to bed at midnight exactly and fall asleep immediately, and then I wake at 2 o'clock in the morning feeling as if I hadn't slept at all. So I get out of bed and light my lamp, step out into my garden, and I walk from corner to corner of the room for an hour or two, looking at all the pictures on the wall. Then, tired of that, I sit at my desk, without movement, without thought, and without desire. Sometimes I make myself count to 1,000 to occupy my mind, or I imagine a friend's face. I listen for sounds. The cupboard creaks, the lamp gives a sudden whistle. All these sounds disturb me somehow. All tonight, I've been thinking about a strange story I heard. Can't remember where. 1,000 years ago, there was a monk, all dressed in black, walking in the Sahara Desert. At the same moment, several miles away, some fishermen saw another black monk moving slowly across the surface of a lake. This second monk was a mirage. This mirage generated another mirage, and then a third, and so on, until the image had been endlessly transferred from one layer of the Earth's atmosphere to another. You can forget about the law of optics. This monk can be seen on Mars and on the stars of the Southern Cross. But the point of the story is this. Exactly 1,000 years from the day that the monk was walking in the desert, he will return to Earth and be seen by men. It seems that we are now at the end of 1,000 years, and so according to the old story, we can expect to see that black monk any moment now. Where did I hear this story? Did I read it somewhere? Did someone tell it to me? Or did I dream it? No, never mind. To live well and humanly, one must work, work, work with love and faith. Sometimes it seems to me that I've wasted my life, wasted it in idleness and fornication. At any rate, I've now reached the point where reading my name in reviews no longer means anything to me. I'm producing nothing. In fact, when I think about my work, it's as if I were eating cabbage soup from which a cockroach has been taken, if you'll forgive the comparison. So, I've come to a decision. I'm going to make a journey across Siberia to the island of Sakhalin, where there's a penal colony, and I'm going to write a report on conditions there. Let me explain to you. Our government uses Sakhalin to resettle our Siberian exiles once their sentences have run, rather as you did with Australia. Exile. What a terrible thing for a Russian. We've let millions of people rot in prisons all across Siberia, and then we've driven them through the murderous cold for thousands of miles to Sakhalin and infected them with syphilis and debauched them, and then blamed it all on the red-nosed prison warders. But it's not the red-nosed prison warders who are to blame. It's us. All of us. Well, of course, my friends will all think I've gone mad. They'll say Sakhalin's of no interest, and they'll assume I must be on the run from some love affair. But Sakhalin can only be of no interest to a country that does not send thousands of people to it every year and spend millions of rubles on doing so. It seems to me that Sakhalin must be a place of the most intolerable suffering, such as only the human animal can endure. And although my trip is unlikely to make any useful contribution either to medicine or literature for me, it will mean 6 months' incessant hard work, and life as I have certainly never lived it hitherto, and surely 2 or 3 days I'll remember all my life, either in joy or in pain. And when I remember that I regard literature as my mistress and medicine as my legal wife, which is very convenient, by the way. When I get tired of the one, I can slip off and spend the night with the other. It seems to me that I've been treating my wife like a pig and must repay my debt to her. So, I've studied Sakhalin till it's coming out of my ears. The soil and the subsoil, the loamy sand and the sandy loam. I bought myself a sheepskin coat and some boots and a revolver and a knife to cut sausage with and keep the tigers at bay. And thus armed from head to foot, off I shall set. Dr. Kuzhnikov has given me a flask of cognac and instructions only to open it on the shores of the Pacific. I know the journey will be solitary and full of hardships. But then to the lonely man, the desert is everywhere. Greetings from Siberian man, your Homo Sakhaliensis. My hostess has just wiped a teaspoon on her behind and given it to me. Tea is a real blessing on the road. It warms you up and banishes sleep. Were it not for the cold, Siberia would be the richest and happiest of lands. Well, people don't belch in front of you or examine their corns or search for insects in their hair. It's absolutely wonderful. The wives hereabouts are too strong and intelligent to be beaten by their husbands, and if the parents tease the children tease them back. The one bad thing is the sausage, which tastes like a dog's tail covered with tar. I must tell you my impressions so far, though I'm afraid there may be more of myself than of Siberia in them. I'm halfway through my journey. I started by taking the train from Moscow to Yaroslavl, and then I boarded the Volga riverboat for Perm. Upon doing so, I immediately gave free rein to my talent. I went to sleep. I don't know. My soul seemed to be made of jelly, neither cheerful nor bored. The River Volga's all right, though. White churches, monasteries all bathed in the sun, great fields of water, very cozy. You can see tugboats on the river hauling the barges, 4 or 5 of them to each barge, and the barge looks like a stylish young intellectual being pursued by his fat wife and his mother and his sister-in-law and his grandmother. They have him by the coattails, and he's trying to escape. The boat itself, though, is not so good. It whistles incessantly, with a sound somewhere between the bray of an ass and a celestial harp. However, there was a good water closet, with 4 steps leading up to it, Anyone with less experience than me would have taken it for a royal throne. In fact, this water closet was better than the dinner, though I'd have preferred that the dinner was better than the water closet. My innards were so clogged after the celebrations I undertook before leaving Moscow, I had no need of a water closet for some days. I disembarked at Perm and took a train to Yekaterinburg. The people of Yekaterinburg inspire you with terror. They have big bones, huge fists, and little eyes. They're born in foundries and are brought into the world not by a midwife, but by a machinist. You expect the very waiters to murder you. It must be said that all the towns in the western part of Russia are alike. Yekaterinburg is like Perm, Perm is like Tula. The occupation of the townspeople seems to be the manufacturing of clouds. Clouds and boredom. And nature itself is quite disgusting. The Ural Mountains, river banks, bare trees, brown earth and snow. When the wind rises, the rivers have the color of coffee grounds, and you feel quite wretched. And the road between Tumin and Tomsk is simply terrible, the ugliest in the world. You'd have to be a conjurer to put a vehicle on such a road and make it stand straight. As you go along, your carriage takes up 1,000 positions. You grab your head, your sides, you dip and bow as your bags all mutiny and pile up on you. The driver's still seated on his box. What an acrobat! We're not driving, but going mad. Over a ditch, bang on the front axle, bang on the back. And this is the main route between Europe and Siberia, the artery along which civilization should flow. And whenever you complain to the local people, they say, oh, this is nothing. Wait till you get to Kozulka. Kozulka is the bogeyman. People coming from there smile at you mysteriously, as if to say, it's your turn now. And when I say I'm traveling alone in my own carriage, they all look at me pityingly as if I was a dead man already. I became so frightened of this Kozulka that I had dreams about it, in which it became a bird with a long beak and green eyes. As it turned out, however, the Kozulka road is not too bad. The greatest danger on it is roaming vagabonds, though in fact a traveller is quite safe with them. They might sometimes murder an old woman and use her skirt for foot rags, or steal a metal signpost, or they might knock some beggar's brains out, or even gouge out each other's eyes, but they never hurt a traveller. It's 1,000 miles from Tumin to Tomsk. You just ride and ride. I seem to spend my life watching from sunrise to sunset, battling with muddy roads for so long that when occasionally there was no rain and the road was smooth for a time, I felt peculiar, bored even. Sometimes you hear a cry close above you and see two cranes flying. For some reason you become sad. Or you pass convicts on the road, walking in chains, 30 or 40 walking together, their irons clattering. There's a soldier with a rifle on either side of them and two carts following behind. I remember one prisoner who looked like an Armenian priest, and another who was like a chemist, and another like a holy black monk, but terribly grave and emaciated. They're exhausted. How can they carry on? You pass migrant peasants as well, with a serious, intent look on their faces. What courage it must take for them to pull up their roots and say goodbye to their homes, their countries, their familiar way of life. I saw a man with a blonde beard sitting with all his goods in bags at his feet, his children on the bags huddled together against the cold wind. His face said clearly, I've given up. There was irony in this face of his, but it was an irony directed inwards, as it were playing over his own soul, over his past life, which had somehow cruelly deceived him. Couldn't be worse, he said, smiling, but with his upper lip only. A moment later he repeated himself. Couldn't be worse. Then a voice came from another sack. It will be worse. It will be worse. This was Misha, a peasant with a long white moustache and a clean-shaven chin, who carried 2 violins, wrapped in cloth, one under each arm. No point in asking how he came by these violins.
Misha is feeble. He can't bear the cold. He's fearful and feckless and likes his vodka. He's been completely useless all his life, living in his brother's house in Omsk. He couldn't work. He was drunk after two glasses. He was garrulous and tiresome. But he could play the violin and entertain the children sitting on the stove. He fiddled in the taverns. He fiddled in the fields and at the weddings. How he fiddled! But now his brother has sold their wooden cabin and all his possessions and is moving to Siberia. So Misha has to come too, and he must bring his fiddles. I know that when they arrive, Misha won't be able to manage in the cold, and he'll get sick and quietly die. Nobody will notice. And as for the fiddles that used to delight his neighbors, they'll be sold to some convict for a 20 kopeck piece. Children will pull off the strings, break the bridges, and pour water into them. Oh, go back, dear Uncle Misha. After 10 days, I reached the Tom River. It was night, and I had to cross by the ferry. The Tom River, by the way, is inhabited only by toads and the souls of murderers. When we arrived at the riverbank, there wasn't a soul in sight. My coachman had become very quiet. He was normally a garrulous old man, but now he no longer shouted, but started muttering, groaning, like a pigeon. Seeing nobody there, he cursed. God damn them! They're on the other side. Come on, Your Honor, let's roar to them. I should explain that in Siberia, whether you scream with pain or call for help or simply call in general, they call it roaring. The bears roar, the sparrows roar, and the mice as well. The cat's got a mouse, they say here. Can't you hear him roaring? So we roar. The wide river, the invisible far shore, a damp cold in your feet and body. After half an hour of this, my felt boots were like jelly, and I was sick of the river, sick of the stars in the sky, and the silence as of the grave. Then we heard splashing in the darkness, and saw the ferry looming into view, with 5 men rowing on long oars, which looked like the claws of a lobster. The only sound was the men cursing, I suppose because they'd not had enough sleep. You'd have thought from their curses that not only did they have mothers, but that the horses did too, and the water, and the ferry, and the oars, not to mention me. Plague take you! Don't just stand and stare, Your Honor! We drove on to the ferry, and they took the oars. All the way across, I thought, if we do capsize, I'll jettison my sheepskin coat first, and then my jacket, and so on. I watched the ferrymen all the way. They're peasant deportees with no love left for their native land. They don't know how to work the soil, or they've forgotten how, and now they simply hire themselves out as ferrymen on the rivers. Terrible, beaten, wasted, drawn faces, showing how they've been brutalized on the way here, handcuffed, walking the highways, eaten by the bedbugs at night. And here they are, shuttling to and fro on the water. They've no human feeling left. They drink vodka and fornicate and drink vodka. They've become animals. And for me, a dreadful sense of solitude. And then suddenly, on the water, in the darkness, a bittern called. It seemed to be saying, "Don't be afraid, dear Uncle Antosha. I come from the banks of the River Psel. Levitan and the Lindvaryevs have sent me. Oh, what nostalgia! When I return home, I shall immediately go home to Taganrog and start a library." On and on we rode, and then suddenly we arrived, and I was full of joy. It's good to be a coward. It takes so little to make you feel suddenly happy again. I rested for a time in Tomsk, a dull, intemperate town where provincial governors come to die. I'd broken my suitcase and had to buy a new one made of cowhide and a new carriage as well. Gewalt, what expenses I've had. Everything in Siberia is impractical from an economic point of view. Throughout the journey, I paid more than I needed to, did what I didn't need to, didn't say what I should have done, and all the time expected what didn't happen. While I was in Tomsk, the chief of police came to visit me. What for? Because he was a lover of literature and wanted to pay his respects. He even called himself a writer. He became quite excited when he met me and even threatened to read me a play he'd written. But in the end, he didn't read it. He just showed me a nugget of gold. Then he asked me for vodka. All Siberian intellectuals ask you for vodka. When he'd had a drink, he told me all about his affair with some married woman. Later on, he took me on a tour of the Tomsk brothels. It was disgusting. There are no beautiful women in Tomsk, nor the lawlessness of Asia as well. When Siberia gives birth to its new poets and novelists, there will be no heroines, no inspiration from the women. They're so fish cold, you'd have to be a walrus or a seal to have an affair with them. One old man described them well to me. Hard to the touch. The next day, I left my old suitcase behind in Tomsk as a settler, climbed into my new carriage, and set off for Krasnoyarsk. My new carriage turned out to be a sort of wicker basket drawn by a pair of horses, and I sat in it and looked down on God's earth like a baby without a thought in my head. The road from Tomsk to Krasnoyarsk is so bad that I should be writing to the New Times about it. And if I didn't die from the cold, it'll be thanks to my leather overcoat. Oh, my dear leather overcoat. The days passed by as in a lingering illness. Devil only knows where the great Siberian plain ends. Brown earth, the bare branches of the birch trees covered with hoarfrost like powdered sugar. Lakes all covered with ice, cold wind pricking my cheeks. Wild ducks taking wing from my carriage wheels and flying lazily off into the birch trees. Never in my life have I seen such a multitude of ducks. My carriage jolted over the hillocks, turning my innards inside out, but I soon got used to it, and no longer noticed how morning turned to noon and noon to night. I did spit blood a little, and my collarbone, shoulders, and coccyx ached continuously, but on the other hand, my headaches vanished, and my hemorrhoids modestly withdrew. My appetite enlarged. Alakirin! How much bread I've eaten, how much tea I've drunk, how many thoughts I've thought. I daydreamed constantly about food and kept on stuffing myself with bread so as not to dream about turbot and asparagus. I even dreamed about buckwheat porridge. My socks blew their noses. The inside of my felt boots were like a water closet. All that kept me going was some incomprehensible, daring ardor. And at length, I was rewarded. Approaching Krasnoyarsk, I felt as if I was descending into another world. A broad plain like a steppe, the sun shining and the birch trees blooming. Glory be, I thought, I've driven into the summer, into a beautiful, civilized town at last, with clean, paved streets, stone houses, and fine churches. This at last is where real nature begins, real, majestic nature, which in time will become a gold mine for Siberian poets. I stood on the embankment of Krasnoyarsk and watched the river Yenisei. I'd never seen such a beautiful river, not even the Volga. The Volga is modest and demure and melancholy. But the Yenisei is a great warrior that doesn't know how to contain its youthful strength. It seems to me that man began in a spirit of courage on the Volga, but ended with a kind of moaning, which is called song, Russian pessimism, while on the Yenisei he started with a moan, but will end up with such strength that we can hardly dream of it. I watched the river racing towards the ocean, and I looked across at the mountains, which seemed to be caught in a dream, and I thought, what a life there will be one day beside these shores, full, brave, and intelligent. My thoughts raced along, jostling each other like the waves of the Yenisei. I felt happy. If everything in my journey up to this point was prose, then from here on it was sheer poetry. As you approach Irkutsk, you enter the forest, the endless taiga. Birds singing, insects buzzing, pine needles heated by the sun, filling the air with a heavy, resinous smell. The fascination of the tiger is not even its giant trees and its silence and its caressing wild flowers, but the fact that perhaps only the migrating birds know where it ends. Traveling through it, you know that Irkutsk lies ahead of you in the Angara River. But what lies on either side, beyond the forest stretching hundreds of miles in either direction, even the peasants and the coachmen don't know that. All they will say is, it has no end. Men from the farthest north come out of the taiga in sledges drawn by reindeer to buy grain from the local people. But who these men are and where exactly they come from, no one knows. No one can say. One day I saw an escaped convict trudging along the side of the road with his sack on his back. How small his crimes seemed and how small his sufferings compared with the forest. He will die here, no doubt about it. He'll simply die. And it will be like the death of a gnat. If we plan to burn down the tiger, it will be like a man trying to burn down the sea. What mysteries it hides. A path winds stealthily through the trees and vanishes. Where to? To another secret? To a village nobody knows of? Not even the police. To a gold mine? I was driving along, absorbed in these thoughts early one morning, when suddenly we collided with a mail coach coming in the opposite direction, and I was thrown out of my carriage with my bags on top of me. The two drivers got down and started cursing each other. How horrible it was. What grossness of spirit it took to think of such language, dragging through the mud all that's most precious to man. There I stood, before dawn in the open fields, in my smashed bags and the broken shafts of the carriage, and the horses and the black mass on the ground. And I felt as if I was in another world, and that soon I'd be trampled to bits. You can't imagine how desolate it was. So, then we repaired the carriage and took refuge in this peasant's hut. And by that time it was already light, and there were golden tones in the sky, and the heathcocks were calling. I fell asleep for a time and dreamt of my own bed in my own room. I dreamt I was sitting at my own desk and telling my friends how I was nearly killed by a carriage on the Siberian highway. Then I woke and realized where I was. I had a good look round. Absolutely charming. A wonderful room. Light and airy and furnished in a manner our Moscow peasants can only dream of. Outside there's a birdhouse, the starlings. Everyone here loves the starlings, and even the cats don't touch them. Inside, not a speck of dust anywhere. Whitewashed walls, wooden floors, pots of flowers on the windowsills. I've been sleeping in a bed with a feather mattress and a red pillow. You climb this mountain on a chair and just sink into it. Portraits of the Tsar on the walls, Prince Battenberg and General Skobeliev, all the saints, and the peasant and his wife have decorated the other walls with sweet wrappers and vodka labels, and someone's painted a tree on the door growing out of a vase and some red flowers and birds that look more like fish. Well, the demand for art is here, but the good Lord has sent no artists. How can a peasant think about art? For 9 months of the year he can't even take off his mittens and straighten his fingers, and when the summer comes his back aches with labor. My God, though, how rich Russia is in good people. When I woke, I could see my hostess in the next room making bread. And the morning sun was streaming over her brow and her breast and her hands, so that it looked as if she was working sunlight into the dough. Her sister was frying pancakes. The cook was pouring boiling water over a newly slaughtered pig. The husband was making felt boots. Grandmother sat on the stove, moaning, her legs swinging. Grandpa was up on the sleeping platform, coughing. A cradle hanging from the ceiling between the bed and the stove with a baby crying in it. my hostess came in and rocked the cradle. "What luck we have, sir," she said gently to me. "2 months back, a woman arrived from Sretensk with this little baby. She was plainly dressed, you know, but ladylike. Her baby had been born on the road, and then she'd become ill, so we put her up here for a while. She said she was married, but who knows? It's not written on a person's face, after all." "Ours not to judge," puts in Grandpa. "Well, anyway, sir, she was here a week, and then she says, 'I'll be getting back to my husband now, in Sretensk, but I'll leave my little Sasha here with you, and then I'll come and fetch him next week. I'm afraid he might freeze to death on the road now.' So I said to her, 'Well, God sends some people children, 10 or 12 even, but us he hasn't. He's punished us, and we've none. So you leave little Sasha with us for good, and we'll look after him like our own son.' Now, she thought for a time, and then she says, 'I'll ask my husband when I get to Sretensk. I can't do anything without him. I'll write you in a week about it.' And away she went. Well, now it's 2 months, and she's still not written. Heaven has punished us. We love little Sasha like our own son now, but we don't know if he's to be ours or not." "You must write to this woman," I suggest. "How can we, sir? We don't know her name. And Sretensk is a big place. It'd be like finding a needle in a haystack." "There's no chance," says the husband, looking at me, imploringly. His wife gives the crying baby a piece of bread tied in a rag to suck. "We've got used to Sasha, you see. When he starts to cry, day or night, my heart gets light. It's as if we'd come to live suddenly in a new cottage. But if that woman comes back and takes him away..." And she becomes red in the face, and her eyes fill with tears, and she rushes out of the room. Her husband throws a glance at her and smiles crookedly.
"Oh, you've got used to the baby," he says. "It's a shame, of course. What wonderful people." The man's sorry, too, but he's a man, of course, so he can't admit it. I drink some more tea. My next visitor is Grandpa, very interested in me.
"Are you from Russia, Your Honor?"
"That's right, from Russia."
"Never been there. Round here, if a fellow's been to Tomsk, he puts on airs."
"Yes, I've been to Tomsk. It's like a pig in a skullcap, isn't it? In bad taste. Tell me, why is it so cold in Siberia?"
"It's God's will. I was just looking at your gun, Your Honor, wondering how much it cost. You think there's going to be a war, do you?"
"No, no, my gun is for self-defense only."
"Think of that. The newspapers are saying there's to be a railway built round here, Your Honor. But how can that be? It'll work by steam, I understand that, but if it has to go through the village, isn't it going to knock over the houses and crush the people?"
I explain about the rails.
"Think of that."
Just then, an idiot boy wandered in carrying firewood. His arms were as thin as little sticks. He peered at me and mooed like a calf.
"Moo! Get out of here! Go on! Be off with you!" "Now, Your Honor, what I want to make plain to you is this. Here in Siberia, people have darkened minds. They can't make anything. They can't even fish. It's a crying shame, because a Siberian's a good man. He's honest and warm-hearted, and he doesn't drink. He's a treasure, not a man. But his life is wasting, like a mosquito, shall we say, or a fly. What's he living for, Your Honor?"
"Well, I suppose he works and eats and clothes himself. What more does a man want?"
"Your Honor, a human being is not a horse."
The old man sat staring at the table. The wick of the candle was crusted with soot. The rain was beating on the windows now, and I was thinking again of home. In Russia it's May now, and the forests are green, and the lilac and acacia are in bloom. It seems to me that there, too, the wick of the candle is crusted with soot, and somebody's mooing. The riverboat crawls into the Gulf of Tartary. The water doesn't boom or roar, but seems to be knocking on the lids of coffins at the bottom. It's a dismal effect. I'm crossing to Sakhalin with a party of convicts at the end of their journey. At night, they and their guards huddle together for warmth on the deck, their clothes all covered with dew. A soldier may stand in the midst of them, leaning on his rifle, fast asleep. There's one prisoner on board who's brought his 6-year-old daughter with him. Whenever he goes below decks to the lavatory, his daughter goes with him, accompanied by a soldier carrying a gun, and they wait for him outside the lavatory door. When he climbs up again, the little girl climbs up behind him, holding on to his shackles. They're approaching Alexandrovsk Harbor on Sakhalin Island. From the banks come the strains of miserable accordions, and the figures that we pass, standing stock still on the barges in their ragged sheepskin coats, seem petrified by some endless sorrow. I can just make out the lights of the harbour, forest fires belching sparks and flames, and beyond them the mountains. You'd think the whole island was on fire. A lighthouse on a promontory throws its beams into the darkness, lighting up 3 reefs rising from the white spray of the breakers at the entrance to the port. These reefs are called the Three Brothers, but they look like 3 great black monks. I seem to have reached the end of the world. Sakhalin. What's your father's name?
I don't know.
Well, you live with your father. Why don't you know his name?
He's not my real father. He just lives with my mother.
Is your mother a widow, or is she married to someone?
Oh, she's a widow. She came here for my father. She murdered him.
Do you remember your real father?
No, never knew him. I was born on the way here.
There are 3 main groups on the island of Sakhalin. The prisoners, the prison administration, and the ex-prisoners who are now settled on the island. I've been received with the greatest courtesy by the administration and given free access to all the prisoners, so the question is not so much what I see, but how I see it. The only group I am not allowed to contact is the political prisoners, who in any case hardly live like convicts at all. They dress as they choose, and even workers, clerks, cooks, librarians, and church elders, even unofficially as prison warders. Their morale, however, is very low, and there have been a number of suicides, but still their position is nothing like the rest of the prisoners, especially the children. I took lodgings first with a prison doctor with huge side whiskers, rather like Henrik Ibsen. And then with a young official, a decent enough fellow, who spent his evenings writing liberal verse. However, this did not prevent him shouting at the prisoners if ever they omitted to address him as sir. He had 2 servants, both of them convicts. An old woman and a man named Yegor, who wasn't strictly a servant, but would come in and clean for him once in a while and bring in the firewood and generally do anything the old woman hadn't the strength to do. I'd be sitting at my table writing and suddenly there'd be a commotion under the table and a heaving, and there Yegor would be, cleaning around under it. Yegor was 40, a good-natured, clumsy fellow with a stupid face and a mouth like a fish. If you asked him a question, he'd look sideways at you and say, "What do you mean, Your Honor?" He worked night and day, sleeping only 2 or 3 hours, and was always on the lookout for more to do. When he took a holiday,
He'd put on a jacket and a red shirt and stand on a street corner with his stomach thrust out and his legs apart. He called this celebrating. One day, I had a talk with him. "Why were you sent here, Yegor?"
"What do you mean, Your Honor?"
"Why were you sent to Sakhalin?"
"For murder, Your Honor."
"Tell me about it, will you? From the beginning." And Yegor took up a position in the doorway with his arms behind his back.
"I was out gathering wood one day for my master, Vladimir Mikhailich. There was myself and Sergei and Andrei and Ivan. I was on horseback, they were on foot. At Parakino, we stopped for cigarettes at the tavern there. Andrei borrowed 5 kopecks from me to buy vodka. Now, don't you get sozzled, I said to him. I know you, you'll never stop at one glass. Trust me, Yegorushka, he says. So in we went, started drinking.
Come to the point, I interposed.
Just wait, Your Honor.
Sure enough, after the first round, Andrusha called for more. Pepper vodka, 1/2 pint. We drank it and set off home. I remember I got off my horse and sat down on the bank. I sang a song and made a few jokes. We were all friendly. Then on we went.
About the murder, Yegor.
Just you wait, Your Honor. I slept soundly that night. And then in the morning the police woke me. Was it you beat up poor Andrei? And they questioned Sergei and Ivan as well. And they brought him in. He'd been beaten up all right, beaten half dead with a club. He gasps out, "It was you, Sergei. It was you clubbed me. I remember everything." Soon after he died, Andrei. Well, Sergei, he wouldn't admit the crime. But we kept an eye on him as we'd the idea he might do something to himself. We tried to make him confess, but he wouldn't. His family tried as well, except that they said, "Own up, Seryoshka, only blame the others as well. Then they'll let you off lightly." Well, we kept Sergei all that night at our house, but in the morning he'd slipped away. We searched everywhere for him, in the fields, in his village, at his own house. Finally, we learnt that he'd gone to the police station. He'd gone down on his knees and told them that for 3 years the three of us had been trying to get him to kill poor Andrei. "The three of us beat him up," he said. "I hit him a bit, and then I got scared and ran away, and the others, Yegor and Ivan, they finished him off. So they came and arrested Ivan and me and threw us in the town jail. Day after the Feast of the Intercession, they tried us. Ivan had witnesses, and they let him off. I told them just what I've told you, but all they said was, 'Everyone says that. They stand and cross their hearts, but we know it's all lies.' And they found me guilty. I was in jail 2 months, and I learned that if I emptied the pails and swept the cells like I do now, the other prisoners would give me bread from their rations in return. Then they sent me away. I gave 2 rations of bread to my wife and my brother, and I left them. They walked us all the way to Novgorod. They shaved my head and put me in irons. Then they took me to Odessa and penned me up with all the other prisoners in a steamer to come here. It was all right, though. Blazing hot, we all stood around naked. After a while, there was a storm and the ship began to roll. Some of the prisoners threw up, the others just went quiet. Then the boat hit something and stopped. It was as if a big fish was underneath us, shaking us all around. They hauled and they pushed, but they couldn't get the boat free. Then the bottom of the boat split. The water came right up onto the deck. 'Don't let us perish, Your Honor.' 'No one's going to perish,' the captain cried, but he had to let us out of the hold. 'I'll let you out, but if you make trouble, I'll shoot you down, the lot of you.' We said a mass on the deck, all of us on our knees, praying to God to make the sea quieten down. And it did quieten down. They loaded us into another boat the next day, a Turkish boat, and brought us here, to Sakhalin. It took us from Alexandrovsk Harbour to the prison. It was night. We held on to each other in the dark as we walked along. I led a dozen Christian people. They were the most afraid of all of us. They put us in the barracks. 2 days' rest we had, then the third day they bathed us, and the fourth they set us to work. First of all, we dug ditches for a building, the hospital, over there, Your Honour. We pulled up all the stumps and cleared the ground. That took about a month. Then we hauled logs and dug for water in the kitchen garden. Then it was time to mow the hay, those that could. I went to Armadani and mowed. I had bread there and meat, and it was all right. I wasn't beaten once, though the others cursed me because I mowed too fast. After work at night, I wove slippers while the others slept. I sold my slippers, 2 rations of meat for each pair. After the mowing was done, they brought me back here to the jail. Then a settler called Grigori hired me, and I worked in the fields for him. I emptied the pails and swept the cells like I do now. The other prisoners would give me bread from their rations in return. Then they sent me away. I gave 2 rations of bread to my wife and my brother and I left them. They walked us all the way to Novgorod. They shaved my head and put me in irons. Then they took me to Odessa and penned me up with all the other prisoners in a steamer to come here. It was all right, though. Blazing hot, we all stood around naked. After a while, there was a storm and the ship began to roll. Some of the prisoners threw up, the others just went quiet. Then the boat hit something and stopped. It was as if a big fish was underneath us, shaking us all around. They hauled and they pushed, but they couldn't get the boat free. Then the bottom of the boat split. The water came right up onto the deck. "Don't let us perish, Your Honor." "No one's going to perish," the captain cried, but he had to let us out of the hold. "I'll let you out, but if you make trouble, I'll shoot you down, the lot of you." We said a mass on the deck, all of us on our knees, praying to God to make the sea quieten down, and it did quieten down. They loaded us into another boat the next day, a Turkish boat, and brought us here, to Sakhalin. It took us from Alexandrovsk Harbour to the prison. It was night. We held on to each other in the dark as we walked along. I led a dozen Christian people. They were the most afraid of all of us. They put us in the barracks. 2 days' rest we had, then the third day they bathed us, and the fourth they set us to work. First of all, we dug ditches for a building, the hospital, over there, Your Honour. We pulled up all the stumps and cleared the ground. That took about a month. Then we hauled logs and dug for water in the kitchen garden. Then it was time to mow the hay, those that could. I went to Armadani and mowed. I had bread there and meat, and it was all right. I wasn't beaten once, though the others cursed me because I mowed too fast. After work at night, I wove slippers while the others slept. I sold my slippers, 2 rations of meat for each pair. After the mowing was done, they brought me back here to the jail. Then a settler called Grigori hired me, and I worked in the fields for him. I reaped and gathered and threshed and dug his potatoes for 2 months, but he never gave me a penny, though he promised to. Gave me some potatoes, that's all. I came back to the jail again. They provided me with an axe, some rope, and made me haul firewood. I looked after 7 stoves on my own, and carried water, chopped logs, swept floors. I even worked in the Tatar pawn shop. In the spring, I began to make my shoes again, and sold them for 10 kopecks a pair. In summer, I sent the firewood floating down the river, and sold some of it to the old Jew who looks after the bathhouse. 60 logs, 15 kopecks each. I get along, Your Honour. But look here.
I've got water to fetch. I can't stand here talking to you.
Igor, will you become a settler after your sentence is over?
Yeah. 5 years' time.
Are you nostalgic for home?
No. Well, one thing. My children. I'm worried about them. They got no sense.
Why didn't you bring them with you? And your wife as well?
Because they're better off where they are, at home. That's why.
Igor, when they took you to the steamer at Odessa to come here, what were you thinking about?
I was praying, Your Honor. What for? I was praying to God to put sense into my children's heads.
There are blind children here, starved and covered with rashes. Girls of 12 who are prostitutes before they menstruated and are pregnant at 15. Women selling their own daughters. In Alexandrovsk, prostitution is almost a municipal enterprise. A woman in a cell, waiting for trial without food, blinking in the light, dreadfully ill, but without a doctor. The inspector had said, "Let the woman die." The women convicts, many of whom are murderesses, are allocated to the settlers like domestic animals if they're of childbearing age, as part of the colonization program of the island. I attended the funeral of one of these women. Round the grave, the coffin bearers, who were convicts. Further off, myself and a local official like Hamlet and Horatio in the churchyard. Out of pity, another convict had brought the dead woman's children along, a baby and a 4-year-old boy, Alyosha. Alyosha was wearing a woman's jacket with long sleeves and blue trousers with patches on the knees. The waterlogged grave, the cold and the damp, the sea within view, and the convicts laughing for some reason. Alyosha looked into the grave, speculatively. His nose was chilled and he wanted to wipe it, but his long sleeves got in the way. After they'd filled in the grave, I asked him, "Alyoshka, where's your mother now?" And he made a gesture like a man who's been cleaned out at cards and laughed. "Shoveled away," he said. If you want to investigate the morals of the convict community, you can gain only confused, contradictory impressions. The natural method of looking at crime statistics is useless because what we would call trivial offenses that are inseparable from prison conditions are treated with great severity, while serious offenses are often ignored. For instance, though the desire for liberty is natural to man, a prisoner caught trying to escape is punished with the whip and hard labor, and indeed any colonist who sheltered such a fugitive out of pure humanity would be treated in the same way. On the other hand, the frequent robberies are ignored completely. So that if you were guided by statistics, you would think the prison population had a deep respect for other people's property. Hunger, slavery, and fear produce their own vices. To lie and cheat, to thieve and shirk and dodge, are the only weapons available to a humiliated class. The prisoners thieve from each other, they thieve from the colonists, they thieve like consummate artists. One day, they stole a live sheep from the steamer, and a cask of wine, and the commander's compass. You could never find the thief. When a foreign ship was in port another time, they walked into the cabins and took all the silver plate from the dining room. Such artistry is a matter of self-respect. Alexei has been sent to Sakhalin for killing his wife with a hammer. She was a beautiful woman, and he was very much in love with her, but one day they had a quarrel, and he knelt down in front of the icon and vowed to kill her. Every day after that, he heard a voice in his ear saying, "Kill her. Kill her." Afterwards, he gave himself up immediately, and now he's here on Sakhalin. He sits philosophizing all day, or giving lessons, as he calls it, and whenever he sees a crowd of children, he calls out, "Where there are fleas, there are children, too." Once when we were out walking together, he suddenly burst out, "Revenge is a most honorable thing." He lives in the most meticulous way on Sakhalin, in a tidy little room, and above his bed, he keeps a portrait of his wife. evenings the town of Alexandrovsk is bright with lights. Soldiers, convicts, and settlers fill the streets and the band plays. There's no merriment. The people all walk about like shadows, as silent as the shadows. A prison is a prison even in the light of fireworks, and music in the ears of a man without a home merely increases his misery. Living here, among these people, in the tolerable hell that Sakhalin is, has brought me to realize certain things. One is the real meaning of exile. They say proudly in Russia nowadays that capital punishment is hardly ever used, but all the measures that have replaced it, like exile and long sentences, have the same essential feature as capital punishment. They are indeed for life. A man is permanently removed from his surroundings. He dies to his community and loses all chance of redeeming himself. The citizen in him is finished forever. And such punishment denies him even the prospect of peace in the grave, which would be the only feature that would make capital punishment acceptable at all. In my view, capital punishment has not been abolished so much as given another form, a little less repellent to human sentiment. I believe that in 50 or 100 years, these life sentences will be viewed with horror, the same horror as we feel now of the tearing of nostrils or cutting off of fingers. But meanwhile, we seem not to have the expertise or the courage to find a substitute more nearly just. How is this change to come? For years now, all intelligent people have been pointing out that a criminal is the product of a social condition. But really, how indifferent we are to this product. Where is the literature on the subject? Where are the authors? Who will witness to it? Not our judges. Prison problems interest them? Not at all. Such indifference is quite beyond belief in a Christian state. And the reason is that the judges are completely uneducated. They pass examinations which qualify them only to try a man and sentence him. But what happens to that man thereafter, and why, what a prison is, what Siberia might be, that is beyond their jurisdiction. They know nothing of that. They're not interested. It's not their fault. It's all the fault of those red-nosed prison warders. Sometimes a convict stands in silence at a window looking at the roof of a neighboring house. What is he thinking about? Or he'll talk to you about some trifle, glancing sideways at you with a look that says, you'll be going home soon. Since I arrived on Sakhalin, I've worked for 3 months, from 5 in the morning until late at night, and I still feel like a man of the zoo who's seen the insects and missed the elephant. I visited every hut and made a card index of 10,000 convicts for my survey. I've talked to men chained to wheelbarrows. I've enough for 4 doctoral dissertations, and a feeling in my innards as if I'd been eating rancid butter. I've developed headaches. There's something wrong with my eyes. The doctor listens to the prisoner's heart. Then he goes and sits behind his desk. You're innocent, of course, aren't you? You're all innocent. It's just that people are so suspicious, aren't they? Did you have pleasant dreams last night?
I can't remember, Your Honor. The prisoner stands half naked. He's trembling.
Well, here's some news for you. You're sentenced to 90 strokes of the lash. Come with us.
And the doctor slaps the prisoner on the forehead. We walk to the warder's office. On the way, we meet a medical assistant. He seems to be begging for alms.
Your Honor, Your Honor, may I watch the man being flogged?
Inside the office is a sloping bench with openings for the prisoner's hands and feet. The executioner nods to the prisoner. The prisoner lies down without a word. The executioner slowly pulls the prisoner's trousers down to his knees and ties him to the bench. The inspector is glancing casually out of the window. The doctor's strolling up and down the room. The executioner approaches the prisoner.
Would you like a glass of water?
Yes.
Yes, please. For God's sake, Your Honor.
While he drinks, the executioner slowly untangles a whip with 3 leather thongs in it.
Now then, bear up.
He strikes the first blow casually, without swinging the whip, as if he was practicing.
One!
Cries the warder like a church deacon. At first the prisoner is silent and his face doesn't change. Then suddenly a shudder runs along his body and he lets out not a scream, but a squeal. Two! The executioner stands to one side and guides the whip across the body. After every five strokes, he walks slowly around to the other side, giving the prisoner half a minute's rest. The prisoner's hair is stuck to his forehead and his neck is swollen. After the first five strokes, his body has turned from red to purple, and the skin breaks with every blow. He manages to gasp out, "Your Honor, Your Honor, why are you beating me?" After 20 strokes, he's muttering like a delirious man or a drunk. "For God's sake, I'm done for. For God's sake, Your Honor, Your Honor." Then he sticks his head out in a peculiar way and makes a sound like vomiting. He doesn't speak again. There's only a rasping sound coming from his throat. He seemed to have been there an eternity. But the warder's only shouting, 43! 44! I step out into the street. It's quiet there, apart from the sounds coming from inside. A convict comes shuffling past. He steals a glance into the office, and a look of terror comes into his face. He shuffles away again. I go back inside. 89! 90! Prisoner's hands and legs are quickly untied, and they help him up. His body is purple with bruises and dripping with blood. His face is yellow and damp. His teeth are chattering. His eyes are wandering. When they give him something to drink, he convulsively bites the glass. They sponge his face down and take him to the surgery. On the way out, we pass the medical assistant who's asked to watch. He's enchanted. I love to watch the floggings. Worthless scoundrels. I love it. God's world is good. Only one thing in it is bad. Ourselves. There's a woman in the ship buffet who laughs constantly. At the slightest provocation, she bursts into peals of mirth. She has a Russian priest and a Japanese businessman with her, and they're also convulsed with laughter. Never has there been such laughter in the Gulf of Tartary. After our first meeting, the four of us decided to meet again this morning on the deck, properly, for a serious talk. And once again, all we could do was laugh and laugh. All that was missing was for the whales to thrust their snouts out of the water, look at us, and start laughing too. Sakhalin vanishes behind me into the ocean like a dream. Yeah, it seems not such a bad place after all. My trip to Sakhalin either matured me or caused me to lose my mind, the devil knows which. Before I went away, Tolstoy's Kreutzer Sonata was published. It seemed to me a great event. After I came back, it seemed ridiculous and absurd. I wrote a dissertation on Sakhalin and went to Moscow with it to the university to submit it for a doctorate, and the dean turned on his heel and walked out of the room. My friends would have preferred I'd have written it like Dostoevsky. You know, never in my life have I seen such unmitigated horror at the depths to which humanity will sink. When the work was published, the critic Burienin complained about mediocre writers who lose the ability to look straight at life and so wander off to Siberia and Sakhalin. Perhaps I should shoot myself. Throughout my visit to Moscow, it did seem that some strange feeling of ill will was surrounding me. People wined me and dined me, but I had the feeling they wanted to eat me alive. I went to a big dinner to commemorate the abolition of serfdom. All the literary men were there to welcome.
kissing me a lot and wanting to know about Siberian women. Gorky and I did have an interesting cough together. We all drank champagne and made loud speeches about freedom. And all the time, serfs in tailcoats waited at table, and outside in the freezing cold, our drivers waited for us to finish. It felt like lying to the Holy Spirit. What is to be done? At first, it seemed I'd wasted my time on Sakhalin, but later on, I did hear that some of the practices that I saw there, such as head-shaving and the chaining of men to wheelbarrows, are to be abolished. And not long ago, I had a letter from a settler there, an ex-convict who was struggling to live and for whom I'd bought a calf. And he says, "When I look at my heifer, which is now worth 40 rubles, I thank you each day from the bottom of my heart and will always say my prayers for you." So, I'm glad this rough old convict's coat hangs in my literary wardrobe. Let it hang there. I passionately want to talk to you, to tell you everything. A Russian is such a strange creature. As in a sieve, nothing remains in him. In his youth, he fills himself with everything he comes across, but after 20 years, nothing remains but a kind of grey rubbish. A lawyer who's had one successful case no longer cares about justice, figures as a connoisseur of the arts and defends only the rights of property. An architect who's built a couple of decent buildings sits down to play cards, plays cards all his life, nor else is to be found behind the scenes of some theatre. An actor who's taken 2 or 3 parts tolerably well no longer bothers to learn his lines, puts on a silk hat and thinks himself a genius. Somehow, we've all become accustomed to living in hopes of fine weather or good crops or a pleasant love affair, but I've never met anyone who lived in hopes of becoming more clever. How little justice and humility there is in us, and how limited is our patriotism. The drunken, dissolute husband may love his wife and children, but what good is his love to anyone else? The newspapers say we love our country, but how do we express that love? In conceit and brazenness instead of knowledge? Idleness and bestiality instead of work? No justice, an honor for the uniform only. What we have to do is work, work, and all the rest can go to the devil. But instead, we all sit and philosophize about how things will be better in 100 years and better still in 200 years, and nobody bothers about improving things tomorrow. For example, there was a terrible drought in our province last year, and all the crops failed. The governor declared that this was due to the peasants' laziness and drunkenness. Have you noticed how well-fed people have this habit of lecturing the hungry? They mentally divide the population into taxpayers and non-taxpayers, and those who seem more stupid and filthy than them, they call the people. But we are all the people. And the best we are doing is the people's work. The real dregs of our society can be found in the Pullman cars. Oh, dear. I seem to have fired off a leading article from a radical newspaper at you. I must have mania Sakhalinosa. And in fact, I'm not a liberal, nor a conservative, nor a gradualist, nor a transitionalist, nor an indifferentist, nor a monk. I'd like to be a free artist, and nothing else. And I regret that God hasn't given me the strength to be one. One thing I've learned from my travels, in such a way that I can never unlearn it, is that a writer's not a pastry cook. He's a man bound by contract, and once he takes the rope, he mustn't say he can't pull. Now, all my hopes lie entirely in the future. Joyous visions fire me. I'm breathless with excitement. I have a terrific longing for life. What if, by some miracle, this present turned out to be a dream, a hideous nightmare, and we were to awake renewed and cleansed, strong, upright and proud. Why do we never try to stand again when once we've fallen? And when we've lost one thing, why don't we search for another? I want our lives to be holy, sublime, and solemn as the vault of heaven. Let us live. The thief on the cross had hopes, even though he had less than an hour left to him, and the sun only rises once a day, so take hold of what's left of your life and save it. My holy of holies is the human body. Health, intelligence, talent, inspiration, love, and the most absolute freedom imaginable. Freedom from violence and lying, whatever form they may take. That's the program I would follow. If I were a great artist. I walked down my path to the river, disturbing the sandpipers. The last rays of sunlight were still on the pines, but on the water it was dark. I crossed by the bridge and found myself in a wide field of young rye. There was nothing, no house, no sign of life. It seemed as if the path where I was standing would lead straight to the unknown place where the sun had just gone down and the evening glow was flaming in the sky. What space! What freedom! What stillness, I thought, as if the world were watching me, waiting for me to grasp its meaning. At that moment, a wave ran across the rye and a soft evening breeze touched my face. Then came another, stronger gust. The rye rustled, and behind me I could hear the hollow murmur of the pine. I halted. On the horizon there rose, from earth to sky, a tall black column like a whirlwind, or a sandstorm, perhaps. Its outline was unclear, but it was not stationary, but moving with terrific speed towards me, and the closer it approached, the smaller and more distinct it became. I just had time to plunge into the rye at the side of the path. It was a monk, dressed all in black, his arms crossed on his chest, his hair grey, his brows black, his bare feet not touching the ground. He came rushing past. A few yards further on, he turned towards me. What a white, fearfully white, thin face. He nodded at me, in a friendly way. Then, swelling again, he flew across the river, crashed without a sound into the clay cliffs and the pines, passed straight through them, and vanished. So the old story was true. Some years passed. I moved to the Crimea, reaching Sebastopol one evening and stopped at a hotel there to rest before coming on to Yalta the next day. I was tired. I stepped out onto my balcony. It was warm and I could smell the sea. The wonderful bay reflected the moonlight. It had a color difficult to define, a soft blend of blue and green. In places, the water had the dark blue of vitriol, and in other places, it was as if the moonlight had turned to liquid and filled the bay in place of water. What a symphony of color. What a feeling of peace and calm and repose. On the ground floor beneath my balcony, I could hear laughter and women's voices. Party, obviously. I went back to my room. I knew from experience that the best cure for melancholia is work. You have to sit at your desk and force yourself at all costs to concentrate on a single idea. From my bag, I took a notebook that contained some work I'd planned to do if the Crimea became boring. I sat at my desk and started writing, gradually feeling a calm and resigned mood creeping over me. Work led me to reflect on the hustle and bustle of the world. What a price life exacts from man in return for its commonplace rewards. To come this far, I'd had to work for 20 years, night and day, endure a solitary life, and do a number of stupid and unreasonable things that are best forgotten. I saw clearly that I was a mediocrity, and I was glad, seeing that everyone should be satisfied with what he is. A light wind blew in from the sea, sending my papers to the floor. I went out onto the balcony again. Now the bay was like a living thing, looking at me with blue, turquoise, and fiery red eyes. It seemed to beckon me.
Beneath my balcony, a violin started to play and two female voices began singing. I caught my breath. There was sadness in my heart, but also a sweet, long-forgotten delight which made me tremble. I went to bed and started reading a French novel. Soon the clock struck three. I put out my candle and lay down to sleep. I lay for a long time, wakeful, with my eyes closed, the room terribly hot. At 4:30, I relit my candle, and there, sitting in the chair beside my bed, was a man of medium height, with his grey head bare, all in black, barefooted like a beggar. On his deathly white face, the black brows stood out sharply. The black monk. He nodded amiably at me. "Greetings." "What are you doing here?" I said. "You're a mirage. Why are you sitting in my chair?" "A mirage. A mirage is the product of an overheated imagination. I am an apparition." "So you don't exist?" "Think as you choose." "What an old, wise face you have. It's as if you really had lived for 1,000 years. Why do you look at me with such delight? Do you like me?"
"Very much. My friend, your work, your ideas, and your life have been dedicated to everything rational and beautiful, to the eternal, in fact. You are among the chosen people of God."
"How pleasant it is to talk to you.
I'm glad to hear it.
But you are an hallucination, aren't you? Am I mentally deranged?"
"What if you are? You're ill now because you've overworked and tired yourself out. You've sacrificed your health to your ideas, and soon you will sacrifice your life to them. What could be better than that? That is your goal."
I tried to answer, but blood was pouring from my mouth. I didn't know what to do. I covered my chest with my hands, and they became covered in blood. I tried to call out. "Olya! Olya!" I fell to the ground and raised myself on my arms. I called on Olya. I called on my garden, its flowers all covered with dew, the parkland, the pines with their twisted roots, the field of rye, the steppe, my life's work, my youth, my daring and my joy, on my life which had been so lovely. I could see a great pool of blood on the ground near my face. I was too weak to speak, but boundless happiness flooded me. When my wife woke up and came out from behind the screen, the monk was gone. I was lying with a blissful smile on my face. Last thing I remember was, they brought me champagne. I was very glad of it. It's a very long time since I last drank champagne. Please greet the lovely hot sun from me, and the quiet sea. Enjoy yourselves. Be happy. Don't think about illness. And write often to your friends. Every hour is precious. Keep well and cheerful. And don't suffer from indigestion and bad temper.
Chekhov in Siberia was devised and performed by Michael Pennington. The director was Jane Morgan.